ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
श्रीमद् भागवतम् कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 48 कृष्ण प्लीजेस हिज डिवोटीज टेक्स्ट नंबर 3 व्हाट्स द मीटर फॉर दिस वर्स Griham tvam ayantam aveksha sasanat. Sadhya samudhaya hi jata sambrahma. Yatopa sangamya sakibi achutam. Sabha jayam asa sad asanadibi.
Sabha jayam asa sad asanadibi.
Griham tvam ayantam aviksa sasanat.
Griham ayam aviksa sasanat.
Sadhya samutaya hi jata sambrahma.
Sadhya samutaya
Yatopa sangamya sakibi archutam.
Yatopa sangamya sakibi archutam.
Sabha jayam asad sad asa nadibi.
Sabha jayam asad sad asa nadibi.
Griham tvam ayanta griham.
Griham.
To her house.
Yes.
Tam. Him. Ayantam, arrived. Avikshya, seeing. Sa, she. Asanat, from her seat. Sadhya, suddenly. Samuttaya,
rising.
He, indeed. Jata sambrahma.
Being in a flurry.
Yata. Properly. Upasangamya.
Coming toward.
Sakibir.
With her female
companions.
Achyutam.
Lord Krishna. Sambhajayam.
Sambhajayam
asa.
Sambhajayam asa.
Respectfully greeted.
Sat asana.
With an excellent seat.
Adibi.
And so on. Translation. When Trivakra saw him arriving at her house, she at once rose from her seat in a flurry. Coming forward graciously with her girlfriends, she respectfully greeted Lord Achyuta by offering him an excellent seat and other articles of worship. Text 4. Uddhava also received a seat of honor, since he was a saintly person, but he simply touched it and sat on the floor. Then Lord Krishna, imitating the manners of human society, quickly made himself comfortable on an opulent bed. Purport. According to the Acharyas, Uddhava felt reverence for his Lord and thus declined to sit on an opulent seat in his presence. Rather, he touched the seat with his hand and sat on the floor. Since Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur adds that Lord Krishna made himself comfortable on a bed located in the inner chambers of Trivakra's home. Om Jnana Tamanandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Jaina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanshakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyabhacha Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Garadhara Srivasari Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So, here we are reading Bhagavatam, the pastime of Krishna pleasing his devotees. Specifically, this is Krishna going to Drivakra or Kubja's house to reward her for the devotional service she's done, to reciprocate. Now, I was speaking to one guest at Urban Yoga last night, Damien, who's an intelligent Scandinavian lad. And he was saying, you know, look, you know, this Krishna conscious philosophy, Bhagavad Gita, that's wonderful, you know. But is it the only way? I mean, we live in a pluralistic world. Why should we simply adhere to one particular path? There's so many paths. Is that not a case? Is that not the case? And of course it is the case. We live in a world with myriad paths that we can take in spiritual life. The whole world has been brought together by modern transportation and communication. And we can access many traditions of the world just sitting at home on our computer. All the books, all the great books of wisdom in the world have been published by Penguin and other publishing corporations. And thus we have access to these books of wisdom. And not wanting to limit oneself, the modern person likes to look at these different traditions and extract the essence and cobble together one's own spiritual path. This is the tendency of the modern age. And fair enough. Why would one want to get caught up and limited by locking oneself into a particular paradigm? Surely God is, or the Supreme is beyond all these designations of religion and paths. So this was his point he was making. It's a common point. Many people have this question or this train of thought. You know, why should I? You know, Krishna consciousness is nice, but why should I become a devotee of Krishna specifically? Why? There's so many other things. So many other paths, and I don't want to shut myself off from all these options, all these experiences which might enrich in my spiritual life. And when he said that, this statement of my spiritual master, Devamrita Swami, came to my mind, and I said it to him. He said, in one Srimad Bhagavatam class, he said, it's up to you to become convinced that bhakti is the highest thing. Simply. He said, it's up to you to become convinced that bhakti is the highest thing. We're not saying that there is an only way. Krishna doesn't say that in the Gita. He explains everything philosophically from start to finish. And then at the end, what does he say? Now, Arjuna, I have explained everything. Do what you like. Now it's up to you to make your choice how you want to conduct yourself. So this is the broad-minded approach. But that when somebody asserts it's up to you to understand how bhakti is the best thing, that gives us the impression that actually this is something very wonderful, very comprehensive, very complete. I've just got to understand that. And this is the blessing of this tradition. The Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, is that we have so many acharyas coming in different, you know, at different times, who have philosophically analyzed spirituality and extracted the essence from what is superfluous. Bhagavatam itself is just that. Vyasadeva was feeling dissatisfied. He had just written, just divided the four Vedas and written the Puranas, the histories, and Mahabharata, etc. So many wonderful works, teaching both material and spiritual life. But he was feeling dissatisfied. And his spiritual master came and he paid his obeisances, as one should. And then he inquired, dear spiritual master Narada Muni, why am I not satisfied? And Narada Muni said, well, you haven't describe the essence. What is that essence? The activities of Sri Krishna. Or pure devotional service. You haven't pushed that enough and explicitly enough. Therefore, you're dissatisfied. So therefore, what you should do is write Srimad Bhagavatam. And then we read in Bhagavatam in some of the early verses, this Bhagavatam is rejecting all materially motivated religious practice and focusing on the essence. Now, we are lucky actually to have comprehensive philosophy that describes the goal, because many the goal of spiritual life, because many people are very unclear about the goal of spiritual life. Like, you talk to people and they say, I want to do some chakra cleansing. The other day I had a Reiki session. I do some Tai Chi. My girlfriend and I, we like to go walking in the forest. It's spiritual, This is all spiritual. Or you meet somebody, I'm trying to go to heaven or achieve nirvana or whatever. The goal is not so clear, exactly what they're trying to achieve. I was speaking to a professed Buddhist the other day, and I was talking about the conclusion of Buddhism. It is the conclusion that one should extinguish the self. That's the conclusion of Buddhism. Life is suffering, therefore we should extinguish life. And you can't do that just by simply slitting your wrist. That won't extinguish life. One has to remove all the samskaras, or the tendencies to enjoy in the world. Desire. One has to remove all desire. And then the flame will be snuffed out. And she was saying, no, I don't think that's the goal. I said, what's the goal? And she said, she couldn't tell me the goal. I think it's practical day-to-day stuff, like one should be peaceful and compassionate and etc., etc. She didn't know what the goal was. A friend of mine, Shane, he was telling me the other day, he was listening to a lecture by a sober academic Buddhist, who was saying straight up, this modern strain of what people know as Buddhism, it's very watered down and very unfocused. The actual truth is that life is suffering and we should try and withdraw ourselves from life completely. Eliminate all desire and become inert. He said that is the true goal. That is the fact. All this other stuff is nonsense. But most people don't know that. And it's like that with all different spiritual paths. You get the New Age book and it tells you all sorts of stuff, but it doesn't give you any goal. Any clearly defined final goal. But what the acharyas have done is, in our tradition, is they've very clearly defined what is the goal. That goal is to be a pure devotee of Sri Krishna. That's very clear. That we should become free from desires for jnana and karma, for knowledge, mental speculation, and intellectual knowledge, and also karma, fruit of activity. That should be completely eradicated from the heart, and what should be left is pure bhakti, devotion. Nothing but pure devotion in the heart. to develop the character of a pure devotee. Many people, they're attracted to the idea of saints, becoming a saint, somebody whose heart is so pure. A couple of our friends at Urban Yoga, they were commenting when they met Jnanananda. He's very saintly. Very pure. He doesn't necessarily have to say anything particularly profound, but just because of his character, his pure heart, people feel that pure heart, and they thought that's very that's saintly. He's a saintly person, and detecting that, they're attracted. So people are attracted to the idea of this perfect character, this perfect heart. A lot of the Christian tradition ancient Britain and so forth was based on was, whether or not people believed in the, Jesus, the only Son of God, and you accept him into your life and thus become, you achieve redemption and go to heaven, whatever that is. Whether people or not believe that, they did believe in the character of Jesus Christ and the idea that one should be a good Christian. What did that mean? It meant having certain character qualities. So this is something very tangible. And this is what we see in Bhagavatam, that Bhagavatam describes the character of the pure devotees in relationship to the Lord. It's all about the exchange between the devotees and the Lord. And this is a powerful way to explain things, because abstract philosophy tends to go through the mind like a sieve, you know, and nothing really sticks. Because the mind is often finds it hard to hang on to abstract things. There's nothing really to grab onto. But when things are illustrated in stories, that we can hold on to. We can remember the specifics of a story, and contained within that story is the moral or the point. And also, existence ultimately isn't some abstract void or abstract realm. Existence is very specific and personal. Therefore, the philosophy is also for application. It's not just information, it's for application. So when we see, you know, the exchanges described in Bhagavatam between the Lord and the devotee and the devotee and the Lord, we see the manifestation of the devotee heart, of the qualities, of the philosophy, of the understanding, of the values. That comes to life, and that's something we can take tangibly. We can understand by the activities what the heart must be like. So that's the value of Bhagavatam. It doesn't focus on anything else, actually, except these things, this philosophy of the Supreme Person, and also the activities, the practical application of that, the activities, the emotional exchange between the devotee and the Lord. So in this particular section, we're reading, it's very interesting, we're reading about Kubja. And I was tempted this morning to just say, yeah, what Keshava said yesterday, because he gave a very nice class on the subject. But since I'm here, I'll say something. So we're reading about Kubja. Now, this is an exchange between the devotee and the Lord. But it's also, it illustrates a few different points. As the Acharyas explain, there's both positive things we can learn here and also negative things. We can learn what to do and what not to do from this pastime. See, when Krishna entered Mathura, on the invitation of Kamsa, he had come to Mathura with the cowherd men to fight in the wrestling arena. And Krishna entered the day before to survey the city, you know, first time to the big city, wanted to check it out. And various pastimes happened in the street. And at one stage, Kubja, who was a hunchback, she came to offer Krishna sandalwood paste. And Krishna became obliged by this activity, and seeing her hunchback condition, he stood on her toes and took the two fingers beneath her chin and straightened her out. The spine became straight, and she became very beautiful. And enlivened by the touch of Sri Krishna, Kubja became eager to enjoy association with him intimately. And she was pulling on Krishna's dhoti, saying, "You must come to my house and enjoy." And Krishna was kind of like with his cowherd boys and Balaram and so forth. So smiling and then looking at the cowherd boys, he said, "Yeah, surely a girl like you is the most appropriate revitalizer for travelers like us. But I have things to do. But surely in the future I'll come to your house." And in this way he excused himself of this awkward public display. Now Krishna had straightened her out in public, full public view. As a example. You see, if anybody who's got anything to do with management, they should know that the best thing to do, the best thing to achieve a certain result is praise the person who's doing something right. When somebody does something correct, you praise that. And that becomes reinforced. Because one of the most essential elements of management is the principle that people tend to do what's rewarded. You know, rather than just criticizing what's done wrong, the best thing to do is actually praise what's done right. Because people like that, you know, they're praised and they feel good and then they want to get that feeling again, so they do the same thing. So Krishna is doing that. And especially in a public forum, so everybody gets the idea. Because he just killed the washerman who told Krishna he was impudent for asking for the king's clothes. Krishna would kill, so he'd clearly chastise, this is the wrong attitude, and then he'd publicly praise the right attitude of Kubja to instruct everyone. And anyway, he said, I will go to your house at a later date, not now, I have things to do. And in this chapter we see that Krishna is now fulfilling his promise, he's coming to please his devotees, starting with Kubja. He will also go and see Akura. Now, this verse, when Trivakra saw him arriving at the house, she at once rose from her seat in a flurry. Coming forward graciously with her girlfriends, she respectfully greeted Lord Achyuta by offering him an excellent seat and other articles of worship. So we see Kubja's eagerness. She's very eager to serve Krishna. She's leapt up and she's run to the door. Oh Krishna, you have come. Please come in. Now this eagerness, this is a character quality of a devotee that is attractive to Krishna. And also this energetic, enthusiastic attitude and service is also attractive to others and enlivens others. Now, sometimes it's said that the devotees, a devotee who wants to advance should become the dog of a Vaishnava. And sometimes you think, you know, dogs, they're kind of dirty creatures, and, you know, do I really want to become a dog? But, you know, sometimes even in Bhagavatam it said hogs, dogs, camels, and asses. The dog is given as a poor example that one should not be like a dog because why? Because the dog just runs around with uncontrolled senses. But then also the same example, the dog is used to say one the attitude which one should have in serving the Vaishnavas and the spiritual master, be like a dog. Now what is the aspect of the dog's character that they're referring to? What happens when you come home? You know, you've got a dog and you come home. The dog is eager. He runs to the door. Big, slobbery smile on his face. Very eager to see the master. The dog really embodies three qualities, positive qualities. Loyalty. The dog is very loyal. Humble. The dog doesn't mind making a fool of himself, showing his loyalty and affection to the master. The dog is humble, you know. It's just, you know, not trying to cut any profile. Just genuinely eager, like a child, to serve. And also, yeah, this eagerness. The dog is very eager, and to see the master, very eager to serve. So. This quality of eagerness, of unabashed and unashamed eagerness, this is a very attractive quality of the devotee. Both attractive to the Lord, because eagerness is the only price for pure devotion. Eagerness to obtain it. Greed. And it's also attractive to others. When we see somebody eagerly serving the Lord, we say, that person is enlivened with something. I want that. It's attractive. Because to be enlivened, as I spoke last time about inspiration. And everybody wants to be inspired. So when we see somebody very inspired and eager, then we also desire that. And it also rubs off on us. So we see Kubja's enthusiasm, rushing to greet the Lord. Then the next verse, Uddhava also received a seat of honor. Uddhava has accompanied Krishna, since he was a saintly person. But he simply touched it and sat on the floor. Then Lord Krishna, imitating the manners of human society, quickly made himself comfortable on an opulent bed. So Uddhava, feeling reverence in the presence of Krishna, his Lord, he did not want to assume a seat on the same level as the Lord. And this is also the attitude of a devotee. This is the culture, the etiquette. We see in Manu Samhita, the regulative principles of the Brahmachari. Brahmachari is the training ground for all the ashrams, Brahmacharya. But we see specifically the instruction to the Brahmachari is that when you are a master is sitting, one should take a lower seat. One should not relax, you know, the spiritual master comes in and one's kind of like lying there, you know, oh, how's it going, Gurudev? No, one should not do that. One should immediately stand up, offer respects, offer the seat. Why? Because we see that mercy flows from up to down. So by maintaining this humble attitude, one remains teachable, and also the spiritual master is able, the master is able to. He feels that this is a receptive student. And also, just out of general reverence and respect. And this is what Uddhava is feeling. Krishna, he considers the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He knows that. So he's feeling very humble in the presence of Krishna. And he does not want to at all put himself on the same level. So then Krishna goes on in this pastime to entertain Kubja's desire. You know, her desire was to have Krishna as a lover. She was she became excited when Krishna had straightened her out and touched her. She became like very attracted to Krishna, which is not a bad thing. But the Acharyas do explain that Kubja's desire was not pure. And again, that we see, as the first point I made, that it's very clear what the goal is in Krishna consciousness. It's very clear that one's devotional service should not be mixed with lust or selfish desires. That's clear. That's explained. So even Kubja is given as an example of somebody whose heart was not yet quite pure. Why? She wanted to associate with Krishna, that's good. But she wanted to get personal pleasure from it. Specifically, she wanted to get... she had lusty desires. So lust is considered an impurity in devotional service. Lust is both gross and subtle. We have... The more subtle manifestations of lust, desire for fame, profit, and distinction. And that I am special, I'm going to get some reward from my service, and I'm in the form of profit and also distinction. I'm going to be recognized, I'm going to get some boost for my ego. But of course, this is false ego. And then there's gross lust, you know, the desire to enjoy the gross senses. And actually one, gross lust is simply a manifestation of subtle lust. There's studies been done on people who commit rape and things. And they have analysed that actually more than the lust, the physical lust, like I'm just, you know, if somebody just has like a real sexual drive and they just have to do something about it, they have to entertain it somehow. They say this is not the main thing that causes people to commit these heinous crimes. Now, what is the main thing is the desire to control somebody. The desire to feel like I am the master and somebody is at my mercy. This is this is more subtle desire. This is the desire to feel like a controller. So gross lust is simply a manifestation of subtle lust. Now, sexual lust in particular, you know, this is a big thing that every devotee has to deal with, especially when one is young, and also, you know, even to the time of death, it's there. You know, there's one story about the king. I think it was a king. Some personality anyway was interested to see why, you know, this lust. You know, when will it leave me? And he was speaking to a sage. And the sage said, well, let me show you something. And he said, come to the... it was a king. And I think his minister. He said, yeah, I'll show you something. He said, come to this house of this dying man. I'll show you something. So he went around and this man was bed-stricken. About to die. On his last legs. And then the minister, he got... a beautiful daughter to be brought in. I think the daughter of the king. Bring her in. You know, he's in the presence of the king, so it's respectful. But then, as soon as the woman walks in, the man is just eyes follow her across the room. He's about to die, you know. His body, the flesh of his body is diseased and dying. Still, you know, the desire is there. So this is considered a problem, a gross impurity, which also has its roots in the subtle lust or subtle false ego. So why is it a problem? I mean, modern society will tell you it's completely natural. And it's also profoundly pleasurable. So therefore, why should one be restricted? And therefore they look at devotees and say, why do you lead such a lifestyle of restriction? Surely, what's the problem? So what is the problem? We could say that lust, what it does is creates that exploitative mentality. Lust binds one to the bodily conception of life, and one identifies with the senses, and then one wants to exploit the sense objects. This could mean just exploiting Krishna's material energy, or it could be, in the case of sexual lust, it means exploiting the body of another living entity. That is considered a gross impurity, which reinforces the false ego. It's not good for spiritual life. And then it also has these the tendency of increasing the desire for fame, profit, and distinction. And other material desires. The Vedas teach, Prabhupada is quite fond of this quote, he says, the Vedas teach that if you want somebody to advance in economic development, then encourage them in sex life. Because if you encourage a person in sex life, then the motive passion will increase. Just like Keshava Prabhu was saying yesterday, you know, in the Westgate Bridge, the cars are flooding into the city. And it's all a manifestation of lust, sex. Because as the sex desire, this passion increases, so does the desire for material acquisition. Fame, distinction, adoration. And actually Nityananda Priya Prabhu was saying the other day, he was saying, you know, we could ask, what is the difference between the devotee who just simply remains brahmachari and is very humble and satisfied in that condition, and then the devotee who feels the need to get married. And he said, he's a married man himself, and he said, you know, honestly speaking, I was saying, yeah, you know, they need companionship, they've got to satisfy this desire, you know. He was saying, you know, more than that, you know, the real essence of it is that they have more desire for fame, distinction, and adoration. And they desire to feel important. This is the desire. The subtle desire is more prominent, and it needs to be dissolved. So all this is increased by sexual activity. There's one quote here from Bhagavatam when Lord Rishabhdev is speaking to his sons. He says, Pumsa Striya Matuni Bhava Itam Teo Mitho Hridaya Grantam Ahur Ato Griha Shetra Sutopta Vittaya Janasya Maho Yam Aham Mamiti. The attraction between male and female is the basic principle of material existence. On the basis of this misconception, which ties together the heart of the male and female, one becomes attracted to his body, home, property, children, relatives, and wealth. In this way, one increases life's illusions and thinks in terms of I and mine. So it basically increases the false ego. Prabhupada quotes, I got this from Vedabase, I was looking up this verse, and Prabhupada has quoted this in a purport, and then he comments, when a man and woman exchange feelings of lust, both of them are victimized, and thus they are bound in the material world in various ways. So it's binding. It binds one to the illusion of material self and the material world. So it's a problem. It should be cleansed from the heart. And it's also just an impure stain on the perfect cloth of pure devotional service. Like a white cloth, pure devotional service like a white cloth. And every living entity is a pure devotee. But then they have these various impurities covering them. And this the stain of desire for personal profit, personal pleasure, this is an impure impurity. You know, it said that the gopis, they were so pure that when happiness came to them, they were happy because of the association of Krishna. They cursed that happiness because it was distracting them from their meditation on serving Krishna. So Kubja had this impurity. Now, the point is that Kubja approached Krishna and that purified her. Now that's really the essence of this this pastime. We see you know, the Buddhists and so forth, they also consider lust a problem. And there's one story my friend David told me recently. This Buddhist monk, he was meditating. You know, sometimes when you're meditating, things come into the mind which you don't want to be there. In fact, practically constantly. Anyway, he's meditating and he became sexually aroused. You know, it actually manifested in his body, this sexual arousal. And he became so frustrated with this repeated occurrence that he dismembered himself. And then the doctor said, "My God, what have you done? Let us reattach your member." And he said, "No, I'm sick of this. It's too much of a problem. It's always distracting me. Let's get rid of it. I don't want to deal with it anymore, you know." So it was a distraction. He acknowledged that. I was trying to meditate on my pure self, my pure non-self, whatever. And this distraction kept coming into my mind. You know, this lust. Therefore, I'm going to take this drastic measure. You know, Buddhists, they also have these other meditations, you know, like when lust starts coming into your mind, you know, you're meditating in the mind, you see the flowing hair of a beautiful woman. You say, what's beautiful about this hair? Just analyze it, you know. Imagine if you find a lump of hair in the rubbish bin. Sometimes when you go into bathrooms, you know, there's people put lumps of hair in the rubbish bin. Or it's clogging up the shower drain. Does that make you lusty? Meditate on it, you know. The true nature of hair. What about, you know, you look at the beautiful mouth or the opposite sex and you think, wow, that's attractive. You know, it's not attractive. You know, think of disembodied mucus that somebody's just spat out. Does that enliven you?
No.
You know, think of the true nature of the body, you know. The teeth, for example, beautiful teeth. She had beautiful teeth like Rosa Bilge. You know, think of a disembodied tooth, the true nature of the tooth. Does that enliven you? So they have all these meditations where you analyze these different parts of the body in isolation, you know, when they're not moving and the skin and so forth. Like Vidyananda Swami gives the example, you know, a man just wants to touch a woman's skin. If he can touch a woman's skin, he just gets an electric shock. He said, that's no problem, you know, she can just go in the sun, tan a little bit, peel a little bit, take off some skin, give it to him. He can keep it in a drawer and touch it whenever he wants. So the point is, of these different meditations, is to dispel the illusion of lust. But still we see, you know, this Buddhist monk, he was meditating and he had a problem with this lust. So he had to take this drastic measure. Krishna explains this in the Bhagavad Gita, that the impersonalist, the one who is trying to simply control the senses without a higher taste, his condition is very precarious. Why? Because even one of the roaming senses can carry away his determination, his intelligence. So, as devotees, we're also trying to discipline and control ourselves and purify the heart of all these impurities. What is our approach to doing that? Our approach is simply to go to Krishna. Approach Krishna. Somehow or other, approach Krishna and in that process become purified. And there's so many examples of that. We can specifically study this this part of Chaitanya Charitamrita where Krishna explains himself, how he operates. This is Madhya Lila, chapter 22, the process of devotional service, as Lord Chaitanya explained to Rupa Goswami. And we're going to start from text 36, I think. Yeah, we'll start from text 36. This is a Bhagavatam verse. Akama sava kama uva muksha kama udaradi. Tivrena bhakti yogena yajati purusamparam. Translation. Whether one desires everything or nothing, whether he desires to merge into the existence of the Lord, he is intelligent only if he worships Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by rendering transcendental loving service. So whether one desires everything, the whole world, unlimited desire, or whether one desires nothing, what should he do? Or even if he desires liberation, what should he do? Simply approach Krishna. And then text 37. If those who desire material enjoyment or merging into the existence of the Absolute Truth engage in the Lord's transcendental loving service, they will immediately attain shelter at Krishna's lotus feet, although they did not ask for it. Therefore, Krishna is known as very merciful. Krishna says, if anyone engages in my transcendental service, but at the same time wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he is very, very foolish. Indeed, he is just like a person who gives up ambrosia to drink poison. So this is Kubja's condition, you know. She had the opportunity to be a pure devotee, but she still had some material desire. And this is Krishna, you can consider this, this is how Krishna was thinking when dealing with Kubja. Since I am very intelligent, why should I give this full material prosperity? Instead, I shall induce him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material enjoyment. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so, but he does not award anything which, after being enjoyed, will cause someone to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. When one has other desires but engages in the Lord's service, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where one will forget all other desires. When someone engages in Lord Krishna's devotional service for the satisfaction of the senses and instead acquires a taste to serve Krishna, he gives up his material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. When he was being benedicted by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Dhruva Maharaj said, "O my Lord, because I was seeking material position, I was performing severe types of penance and austerities. Now I have gotten you, who are very difficult for the demigods, saintly persons and kings to attain. I was searching after a piece of glass, but instead I have found the most valuable jewel. Therefore I am so satisfied that I do not wish to ask any benediction from you." So this is the point. By approaching Krishna for fulfillment of her desire, Kubja was purified by Krishna. Just like Dhruva, you know, he was trying to get a kingdom. He approached Krishna, and then this desire fell away. And eventually saw Krishna, and they saw the form of Vishnu, and said, you know, "I was so full. I was such a fool approaching you for material desire." And we see this is how it works also in Krishna consciousness. Whatever attachment one has for the devotees or devotional service, we should encourage that and facilitate that. This is the preaching principle. And then just gradually you see, as they approach, as they get more involved, the other desires fall away. And they eventually desire to become pure devotees. The goal becomes clear to them. It's actually, and the illusion of all these other desires becomes revealed and dissolved. And they just, all that's left is this pure, unstained cloth of devotional service, pure devotional service. So I'll wind up there today. Thank you for your attention. Does anybody have questions or comments on these points? Okay, thank you very much.